Ben Bernanke takes the stand in Washington
and defends the Fed's controversial stimulus efforts.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Adrienne Hill in Los Angeles, in for Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, February 9th.
Coming up, if you're a financial analyst, does it pay to get it wrong all the time, as long as you get it right just once when everyone else is wrong?
Also, gum makers come a step closer to Willy Wonka's vision.
But first, let's get to this morning's hearing on Capitol Hill. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is defending the Fed's $600 billion bond buying program in front of the House Budget Committee. That committee is now controlled by Republicans who are expected to be tougher on Mr. Bernanke. Richard DeKayser is an economist with the Parthenon Group, and he's with us now from Boston. Richard, you in for some must-see TV this morning?
Yeah, I think it will be interesting. The chairman has been vigorously defending this policy because it's fallen under political attack. I think he'll do more of the same. And he's going to basically try and make the case that it's working. You know, long-term interest rates have declined. The Federal Reserve has been announcing these various programs over the past couple of years. Each time it makes the announcement, we see mortgage interest rates in particular move down. So I think he's basically going to try and make that case.
But we did see this morning that mortgage interest rates are on their way up again. The 30-year fixed, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association, is now up above 5%. Does that signal that the Fed's efforts are not working?
No, I don't think so. I think this is losing the forest for the trees. You know, it's true mortgage interest rates have increased about a percentage point since their lows last October. However, last year, mortgage interest rates were under 5% for the first time in a half a century. It's important to recognize that that was truly extraordinary. And even at today's levels, and even if they should rise further from today's levels, these are still extraordinarily low interest rates by any historical standard.
Richard DeKayser, economist at the Parthenon Group, thanks so much for your time, as always.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks to those climbing interest rates we were just talking about, the Mortgage Bankers Association says applications for home mortgages dropped 5.5% last week. There is one part of the real estate world, though, that was thought to be in big trouble and isn't looking so bad these days. Commercial real estate, malls, office buildings, and apartment complexes. Let's turn to Faith Hope Consolo of Prudential Douglas Elliman Real Estate. She joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
What happened? Because people were talking about the commercial real estate market as the next shoe to drop in the economy.
The way the market goes, real estate goes. And once the confidence came back in the stock market, people said, you know what, it's not that bad.
Are there places that are not seeing a comeback?
Well, a lot of the resort areas have struggled, although Las Vegas and Florida lead in the resort areas, but only in the main and main, only Disneyland and the heart of Las Vegas. Other very she-she high-end resorts are just now seeing interest again.
One of the big parts of the commercial real estate market is obviously office buildings, and they have been hit very hard as people have been laid off and offices have been emptied out. What's going on that front?
A lot of the law firms and accounting firms expanded during this time because everybody needs the help to crunch the numbers. They filled a lot of those gaps. For the first time, and I've done this over 20 years, I've seen the landlords and the tenants work together as a team. I've seen deals be more creative, more concessions. The landlord's crown got tipped. He wasn't king anymore. He decided he had to reach and make compromises, and they did.
And lower rents.
Lower rents, longer rent-free time, great concessions. And we saw short-term commercial leases, which we've never seen before for offices.
Faith Hope Consolo of Prudential Douglas Elliman Real Estate, thanks so much for your time.
And thank you.
The White House is expected to offer up some ideas for the future of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac by the end of the week. According to the Wall Street Journal, one idea is to phase out the government-backed mortgage companies without replacing them. That could leave most future home loans to the private market. Marketplace's David Gura is with us now to help explain. Good morning, David.
Hey, Adrian.
So what are the biggest changes that a U.S. homebuyer might see coming out of these proposals?
Well, it'll be more difficult and more expensive for homebuyers to buy high-priced homes. Right now, the government helps homebuyers purchase houses with a backstop on mortgages of up to about $730,000. That number would go down to $625,000. I talked to Susan Wachter, a real estate professor at Wharton, And I asked her how big a difference that $100,000 would make.
It will make a big difference, absolutely. And over time, this is likely to come down farther as well.
Some people might think only well-heeled home buyers would feel that.
It's a lot of money, yeah.
But Wachter told me many customers would probably feel it, especially in big cities.
Now, do these proposals actually have a chance to become law? Is this going to happen?
Since the financial crisis, U.S. taxpayers have spent about $135 billion on these two companies, so I don't think anybody's really thrilled about that. You know, I think there's agreement the mortgage finance system needs to change, but we haven't seen much in the way of concrete proposals or legislation. In other words, there's been a lot of talk, but not a whole lot of action. Susan Wachter told me she thinks the ball's rolling.
Industry needs to be at the table. Housing folks need to be at the table. Congress obviously will be there, and the public as well.
She says the government's going to move slowly and carefully so it won't upset the market.
Marketplace's David Gura in Washington, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now on to one more debate in Washington. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency is expected to face a hostile audience today. The Republicans on the House Energy and Commerce Committee have called Lisa Jackson to testify. As Sarah Gardner from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk reports, they want to block her agency from regulating pollution linked to climate change.
After Congress failed last year to pass limits on greenhouse gases, the EPA decided it had to take action. The agency is now developing new standards for emissions from fossil fuel power plants and petroleum refineries. But Republicans are fighting back. The new chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee has introduced a bill to strip the EPA of its authority to regulate greenhouse gases. Fred Upton calls the new rules an EPA power grab that will raise energy prices and threaten the economic recovery. Mark Bernstein, managing director of the USC Energy Institute, expects the EPA will survive this legislative assault.
I mean, it's clear that it wouldn't pass the Senate or that the president would veto it anyway. So yeah, it's sending a message.
The message that Republicans are keeping up the heat, not only on climate change regulation, but big government. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, February 9th. I'm Adrienne Hill.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world.
Protests in the Middle East are scaring off tourists, which is bad news for countries like Egypt and Jordan, where tourism is an economic lifeline.
This week, Marketplace's Alisa Roth is in Jordan looking at the economic problems this key U.S. ally is facing. She reports that tourism revenues there have slumped in recent months.
On a hill overlooking downtown Amman, a group of around 40 tourists from Poland are snapping pictures of the impressive view, the remains of a Roman temple and an almost intact amphitheater. Just like in Egypt, Jordan's archaeological sites are a big draw for visitors from all over the world. This group's tour was supposed to make stops in Jordan and Israel and Egypt. The Egypt part got canceled because of the political turmoil. Two members of the group decided to bail. Marek Kucharski is an English teacher in Krakow. He never considered canceling.
No, I'm not afraid, you know, of the terrorist attacks and nothing like that. So, neither are my friends. You know, well, as you can see, right, well, we're just visiting the places and we're not afraid.
Not everybody's so intrepid. Safe Saudi arranges visits to Jordan for groups and individuals.
The Europeans, the Americans, we've had lots of clients cancel. Lots of clients are asking us all the time what's going on.
Right now, Saudi's spending a lot of time doing crisis management, trying to convince people that not every country in the Middle East is the same, and that in spite of a few protests, Jordan is still perfectly safe. But a lot of people aren't buying that.
People might cancel because they think, oh, it's the Middle East, it's one country. But it's not. I mean, the distance between us and Yemen is more than the distance between Jordan and Italy. So it's in a different part of the world.
Those mileage calculations may be a little off. But Saudi's complaint that tourists' ignorance is costing Jordan is right on. He says if the cancellations keep coming, his business will be down 40%, which is similar to losses in other parts of Jordan's tourism industry. And even if calm returns to the region soon, the tourists might not. In Amman, Jordan, I'm Alisa Roth for Marketplace.
Two stock exchanges, one in London and the other in Toronto, have announced this morning they plan to merge. If regulators okay the deal, it'll create one of the largest exchanges for mining and commodity stocks.
For more, we go to reporter Christopher Worth in London. Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning.
So how big of a deal is this for American investors and the rest of the world?
Well, if you look at the numbers, the London Stock Exchange is worth about $4 billion. The Toronto Exchange, about $3 billion. And this merger could increase the pool of money that's out there chasing after these Canadian mining stocks by bringing in more British and European investors. And this is also part of a trend, big mergers across the board in a number of industries, including stock exchanges. The Singapore Exchange recently announced plans to merge with the Australian market. And the London and Toronto exchanges say this deal will create savings for them of $56 million.
So that's big money. How does this actually work, though?
Well, even though we still tend to think of a bunch of traders, you know, frantically gesturing in a pit.
With their really cool jackets?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's not what this merger deals with. I spoke with Andrew Hilton at the CSFI think tank here in London.
The days of open outcry are over. There aren't going to be, you know, thousands of people in London speaking with Canadian accents and with, you know, stripy jackets. It isn't going to be done that way.
So, you know, these exchanges are done electronically these days. If you were to walk by the London Stock Exchange here, you'd hardly know that such a large volumes of were being traded inside.
All right. Christopher Worth in London. Thanks, Christopher.
Thanks.
Well, the exchange merger isn't the only news shaking commodities markets today. The United Nations issued a global alert over a potentially devastating shortage of wheat coming from China.
The country is suffering from a significant drought in its northern breadbasket region. As Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, the coming shortage will stretch around the world.
The Chinese have already been noticing something's off when they visit their favorite noodle shops. At this hole in the wall in Shanghai, management didn't even have time to print new menus. Instead, waiters crossed out the old prices with a pen, adding the equivalent of 12 cents to anything made with wheat. Those menus might look even messier in a couple of months, says Ma Wenfeng, a Beijing analyst who follows China's grain markets.
If these weather conditions continue through April, the price of wheat in China will increase by 20 to 50% more. This is a serious problem.
A problem that'll soon reach into American pocketbooks. This is the latest issue that's contributing to record levels of inflation in China. Ma says investors around the world are already responding to the wheat shortage and driving the price of wheat futures in the U.S. to record levels. That means that everything from bread to a box of, yes, Wheaties, will cost more to make and likely more to buy. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, there's chewing gum out there that actually does more than wipe out your coffee breath.
Aha.
Yeah, gum companies Stride and Trident are adding vitamins and herbs to some of their gum flavors, according to the New York Times. And here we're thinking vitamin B, ginseng, and white tea. Sound good? As ingredients in gums with names like Kinetic Fruit, Vigorate, and Rejuve. You know, I'm kind of surprised this hasn't happened already. It sounds to me like we're getting a little closer to Willy Wonka's three-course gum meal. Remember that? With tomato soup, roast beef, and blueberry pie.
Yum.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, February 9th. I'm Adrienne Hill.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. You can give us your feedback by going to marketplace.org and clicking on the link that says Contact. Well, on Capitol Hill today, there's a hearing on the potential for a crisis in the municipal bond market. But the hearing's star witness, financial analyst Meredith Whitney, won't be there. She cites scheduling conflicts. Whitney famously and accurately predicted the collapse of the banks in 2007. But late last year, she sent the municipal bond market into a tizzy with another doomsday prediction that some are skeptical about. For more on all this, let's bring in Robin Farzad, senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
So Meredith Whitney, this analyst that a lot of people on Wall Street know about, she was asked to testify in Washington. She's not going to testify. What's this all about?
The sleepy gentleman-like municipal bond market all of a sudden is this just bastion of controversy. Look, she made a name for herself correctly predicting the banking crisis in 2007 as an iconoclast. But now she's trying to come out and double down and say that the municipal bond market is going to explode and we're going to see 50 to 100 defaults and this is going to propose another systemic collapse.
And what's wrong with that?
There's been a sort of very public peer review where she's been called out by professors and fellow credit analysts and saying that really there isn't substance to this analysis. analysis. It's just for shock value.
Seems like there are a lot of people in this category that made one great prediction, and since then they've been predicting doom and it hasn't come true. Is this just about trying to repeat success and make money for themselves?
This is an evergreen theme that we see in bull and bust cycles. I mean, people who called the 87 crash really were never heard from ever again correctly. And we're seeing a lot of this also from Nicholas Nassim Taleb and Nouriel Roubini, two of the other big doomsayers who were correct.
Is there an advantage to being wrong most of the time if you get it right once when everyone else is wrong?
Well, Nassim Taleb's model, certainly, I mean, he'll come out and tell you that he can get it just, you know, modestly wrong or be par for 14 years and be spectacularly correct for 1 year with this, you know, outlandish prediction and make money for his investors.
As long as it doesn't hurt the municipal bond market, I guess everyone else is okay with it.
Spray and pray.
Robin Farzad, senior writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jeremy.
The mafia has infiltrated the tomato market. In fact, Italians are being urged to boycott one of the most famous tomato brands from Sicily in order to take money away from Italian organized crime. The BBC's Mark Duff has more from Milan.
If Tony Soprano went shopping for tomatoes, he'd probably keep an eye out for the Pacchino label. Pacchinos are reputed to be the best of the bunch, and they aren't cheap for shoppers to buy. But not all that money goes to the tomato farmer. Allegations have now surfaced that most of it goes to the mob. In fact, when a shopper buys $5 worth of tomatoes, the grower typically receives less than 50 cents. Alessandro Di Pietro is a consumer advocate and TV personality in Italy.
There's no doubt that every time we pay 11 times what we should, let's be frank, we're also putting money into the hands of organized crime.
Di Pietro cited Italy's top anti-mafia prosecutor to back up his claims and then urged housewives to stop buying the Sicilian-grown tomatoes. That's infuriated many Sicilians who've been trying for decades to shake off their island's mafia stereotype. But the country's parliamentary anti-mafia commission is taking the allegations seriously. It says it's going to investigate the claim. In Milan, I'm the BBC's Mark Duff for Marketplace.
And finally, Adrian, to the UK, where one woman has spent $160,000 on her dogs.
That's amazing.
Yes, and she wants to help others do the same. I don't know if you're interested in doing something like that with your dogs. Her three terriers have Swarovski crystal collars, designer clothes, and custom-made beds made out of ostrich feathers and faux fur.
I just don't even know what to say. It's
yeah,
crazy.
And exactly. And they even get weekly massages, which is my favorite part. Now, their owner, Louise Harris, is cashing in. She's going to get her own TV show, and she's opened a store called Diva Dogs. Very appropriately named. And if you want to see the pictures of these hilarious terriers.
And I do.
You can go to our website at marketplace.org, the home for everything amazing on the internet. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Adrian Hill in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.